keeping it running, as a matter of fact. Little car talk here with our friend Dan Burns from Lloyd's Automotive. Dan, John Hines in for Denny Long. How are you this morning?
I'm great, John. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you. I know we've talked about this in the past, but you and I have a bit of history together. The same grade school, years apart, but in parts of the same neighborhood, as a matter of fact. So, hey, a very chilly morning this morning. Let's talk about a couple of things right up front. First of all, for people who want to find out more, I love to get this up front, and we'll do it again along the way here. But Lloyd's Automotive, how are people getting in touch these days?
Well, any way you can. Come on over. give us a call. More is better. Probably the handiest thing nowadays is our website, which is at lloydsautomotive.net, L-L-O-Y-D-S, lloydsautomotive.net. And on the website, you can find, you know, photos and services and all that, times and phone numbers and all that sort of stuff. So that's a great place to start. You're sure welcome to give us a call as soon as this morning at 651-228-1316. Or come on over and take a look around and see what you think. We are at 982 Grand Avenue in St. Paul, which is right between Lexington and Victoria.
All right, and Dan will be with us this morning until we get up to our good friend Jack Farrell from Haskell's. Let's talk about this, though. First of all, people want to text or call into the show this morning. They can do that at 651-461-9226, which is WCCO, 651-461-9226 to talk or text that way. I got to ask you this, Dan, thinking about this, a chilly morning. We've had some bitter cold mornings here of late. Did you ever do this when you were growing up? I mean, I know obviously you wouldn't do it now, but did you ever do that garbage can cover full of charcoal and slide it under your car to warm it up when it was a little bit cold? Tell me you didn't do that.
Yeah, I never did that, and in fact, I never burned up a car doing that either. You know, the trouble with putting flaming coals under your car is, if you have any oil leaks or anything, they're all going to start on fire. And besides, you have all, nowadays especially, you have all sorts of plastic and rubber hoses and lines running underneath the car, and you definitely don't want to get that. And then, even worse, most cars now on the undercarriage have all sorts of plastic and felt covers for noise dampening, and, of course, that's all going to start on fire. So don't do
no
that.
Good.
That's a terrible idea.
No good can come from that. Another good way to say it. Hey, here's a text that came in early, Dan, before you had a chance to even join us here. Just wondering if you know of a good way to remove the dealership stickers that are put on the back of vehicles before they've purchased them. My brother, who is in the automotive business for years selling cars, said, you know, just ask your dealer ahead of time. They, you know, if they would mind leaving that off, and most often they should be okay with that. But how do you get something like that off if it's already there?
Well, you know, getting the sticker off itself is easy. You just got to get behind it and peel it off. It's a plastic sticker or vinyl sticker that will come off. The trick is getting the glue off. The glue is just like anything else in life that you would be dealing with. Use some sort of solvent or goo type cleaner, and it'll click. Well, I wouldn't say quickly. It will eventually take it all off and will not hurt the paint. And I was having a conversation with somebody the other day about, you know, they had some graffiti done to their car and had it spray painted. And the good news is, the paint from the graffiti comes right off with many types of solvents, and it will not damage the paint or clear coat at all. So, you know, if you see that, it's not such a disaster. It's actually pretty easy to clean up.
That would be my concern, is wrecking the finish below that. But if we're good to go, we're good. Hey, here's a text too that came at 651-461, make sure I'm doing this number correctly, 9226. Somebody wants to know, the rubber seals around my car doors are old and ripped, as oftentimes some of those things do that. Can I replace these myself? That's the question from one of our listeners, Dan.
Well, if you're a little bit handy, you sure can. There's nothing special about them. They, you know, the rubber seals, if you start taking them off, you'll see that they actually come off pretty easily. There's perhaps some clips that will be holding them in. See that they actually come off pretty easily. There's perhaps some clips that will be holding them in, but mostly they just are pinched around a metal pinch weld, and oftentimes they're just form fitted, so they peel right off. And then to replace them, it's the same thing. You just get started and go around the edge, and like I say, there might be a couple of clips that need to be plugged in the right spot, but pretty much it just is form fit and stays in place by itself.
Okie doke, good. Chatting with Dan Burns from Lloyd's Automotive. And again, if you go to lloydsautomotive.net, that's the best way to get in touch. Steve's on the line from Hutchinson with a question for you this morning, Dan. Hey, Steve, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Nice to hear your voice, John.
Oh, thank you. That's nice of you to say that.
I've got a question. I've got a 2004 Mountaineer, and starting this summer, when I go to start the vehicle, the ignition wouldn't unlock at first. I'd have to take the key out, put it back in, do that a time or two, and it would turn over. Now, in the winter, it's doing it a lot more. I'm wondering if Dan has any thoughts on what might be going on there.
Well, actually, you're lucky, because on that particular vehicle, that key and tumbler assembly is quite simple to replace. You put it in the right position, as long as it's still working. You put it in the right position, find the right button to push, and the whole assembly pulls right out, and it's pretty easy. And I think what's going on is just that you have your key and the ignition switch that it pushes into are not working correctly together anymore. And usually it's because one or more of the tumblers inside that assembly have gotten stuck or corroded or whatever. One time I had a customer, and he had a habit of putting tissues in his front pocket with his keys. And of course the debris from his tissues would go in the keyhole every time.
Oh,
eventually
gee.
It completely wrecked that. But something like that is what's going on. But the good news is you're on your car. It's a pretty simple assembly to replace. So if you bring it in, you won't expect to have a real big bill to do that.
Oh, well, that's good to know. It's when you least expect it here. So, hey, can I ask a question? And again, I'll remind everybody, 651-461-9226. That's text or talk if you've got a question for Dan Burns from Lloyd's Automotive. You know, I've got one of those cars that are becoming more prevalent now. They shut down, or they go into like shutdown pause mode when you are stopping for a light or something of that nature. I got into a discussion with somebody, and we were talking about the idea that, well, he said, nah, that's too hard on the starter. I don't like doing that. My thinking was that the engineers behind the automobile that came up with that, Dan, would have thought all of that through and known what does and doesn't work. You think I'm mistaken here, or am I out of bounds? Give me your thoughts on that, because I know there's overrides oftentimes.
I can tell by your grade school education that you have great common sense. That's exactly right. That's what it takes, is that, of course they designed it to do that, and it's been well tested, and it's been around for a long time. So I agree with whoever you were talking to that I find it kind of annoying. I don't love using that feature, maybe because I just have never done it and I haven't gotten used to it. But at any rate, certainly the car is designed to do that, and the manufacturer paid a lot of money to allow that feature to work on the car. So there's no reason not to use it. Go ahead and use it. It's just a great idea.
All right, good stuff. Chatting with Dan Burns from Lloyd's Automotive. We're talking some car talk. Again, 651-461-9226. Or you can always go to lloydsautomotive.net. You'll find all the follow-ups that you need there, too, for phone numbers to call in, come in. You could even come in this morning morning if you had particular questions or problems. Let's take a break here, Dan. We'll come back with more at News Talk 830.WCCO. John Hines in for Danny Long. Danny will be back tomorrow, next weekend, business as usual. I get this opportunity to sit in with Dan Burns for some car talk here at 651-461-9226. Or always check, too, with LloydsAutomotive.net, LLOYDS. automotive.net. Hey, Dan, Tilly's on the line just east of Walnut Grove, I do believe, right, Tilly? And you've got a question for Dan Burns here from Lloyd's Automotive.
Yes, I'm from Springfield. I have a 2010 Toyota Corolla. About the last two or three weeks it started to do this. When I start it, it will idle at 1,200 RPM. But when I warm it up or drive, or come to a stop sign later on, it idles down to 500 to 600 RPM. So when you accelerate, it gives you a nice little jerk as it goes from 600 up to 1,500 RPM. Why does it idle down when it warms, when it's warmed up?
Good question.
Yeah, I think the fact that it's idling down when it warms up is normal. When the vehicle's cold, the technology would turn the idle up to keep it up, to keep it running, and to warm it up more quickly, because that's when you get the, you know, the best gas economy, and when your car is running its best for the environment, they want to warm it up quickly. But then once it warms up, it will turn the idle down. It sounds like on your vehicle, it's turning the idle down too far. And so that's what needs to be checked out. There's an idle speed controller that sounds like it's working properly because it does go up and down like it's supposed to. Sometimes when the idle is going too low, it's as simple as cleaning the throttle plate on the vehicle, on the intake manifold. It gets carboned up with debris and carbon and so forth, and because of that, the little microscopic air leak that's happening around that throttle plate gets to be too small, and when there's not enough air getting in, it will cause the idle to be too low. So I think that's the first thing I would do if your car was at my shop, is clean that throttle plate real good with some carburetor cleaner, and we actually use a toothbrush, believe it or not.
Ah.
But we do. We clean that up real good. And I think that you'll find that that will improve your idle quality.
Okay, good stuff. Dan Burns, we've got a question from Dean in Glenwood. Hey, Dean, good morning. Here's your shot for car talk here on WCCO.
Good morning. A question I have is concerning, I own a newer Subaru, and when you go to the dealership, they tell you that their oil is formulated for the Subaru Boxer engine. And I was just wondering, is that any better than a Valvoline, Hapaline, Pennzoil? And also, that there is there any difference in the filter they use than one you'd buy from a auto shop?
You know, I'm not a chemist, of course, so I can't tell you for sure that that what they're telling you is exactly the truth. When it comes to oil filters, of course, I've been doing this business for a long, long time, and we've been using aftermarket oil and oil filters in pretty much every car that comes through our shop, and it has worked great for the longevity of the car. And in fact, people who do regular maintenance on their car rarely have engine trouble. So that's a great tip. Do your maintenance and you won't have repairs. But I think that your hunch is absolutely correct, that a great quality oil filter is just fine for your vehicle, and a good quality oil like Valvoline or any of the other name brands is just fine for your vehicle either. So I would feel very comfortable with that.
All right, good stuff once again here. 729, we'll get a forecast details coming up here. And a couple more questions for Dan Burns from Lloyd's Automotive. And don't forget, if you don't get to it this morning, there's always LloydsAutomotive.net or check them out for yourself in St. Paul. We'll be right back. News Talk 830 WCCO. John Hines in for Denny Long this morning. Denny will be back, business as usual. Moving forward, right now I've got Dan Burns with me from Lloyd's Automotive, and we're taking some questions, doing some car talk on a Saturday morning. Ron's with me in Prior Lake. Ron, you've got a question for Dan. What's the question? What's the comment?
Yes, Dan. Say, my son has a 2007 Honda Element, and he just had his catalytic converter stolen. And he has comprehensive coverage on this. So I was wondering, I understand that sometimes the insurance companies, you know, force you to take a cheaper, you know, aftermarket replacement. I was wondering what your experience is with insurance companies on this. And do these aftermarket units work just as well? And any protections that you'd suggest for the future?
Well, the aftermarket ones do work. We do use them often if budget's an issue, and but I think the insurance company is required to put it back the way that that it was before the crime happened. So I think that if I were you, I would persist at least a little bit and try and get an original equipment, a catalytic converter, put back in there if you're dealing with an insurance company. And yes, there are protections that you can put in place. There's cables that are available to go around the catalytic converter, and sometimes we'll weld rebar in the way so that they can't get in there with their saws and cut it and steal it again. But yes, there are ways to protect it, and I think if you actually search the web, you'll find that there's, because there's been, the thefts have been so prolific, there's all sorts of different protection devices that you can purchase and either install yourself, more likely have a professional shop install for you.
All right. Good stuff, Dan. Appreciate that. Gloria is on the line from Mesa, Arizona. Gloria, good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. I have a question. I have a 2019 Ford Escape. I'm considering leaving it in Arizona for the summer months, like from mid-April or from the end of April till mid-October. I'm wondering what to do with the battery. Do I disconnect it or put a battery maintainer on it?
Well, if it's going to be for several months, putting a battery maintainer on it is probably a great idea. Don't use a battery trickle charger. You don't want the charger to continue to charge it the whole time you're gone. You just want to maintain it so that it stays fully charged, and they're automatic that way. But I think I leave my car quite often out in Colorado for a month or more, and I don't do anything. I just leave it, and it's fine. And when I get back, it starts up just fine. But if it went beyond that, I would start to get concerned, because when the car is sitting, there's all sorts of keep alive memory in the computers and things like that, that over a long, long time will eventually wear the battery down. Time alone causes the battery to discharge. And then if it's keeping all of the car alive for while it's sitting, I think after several months, you'll have trouble. So I think the best thing would be to go ahead and use a battery maintainer and keep it plugged in, and I think you'll do just fine with that.
All righty then. Here's one. I have a text from a friend of ours, 951 or 651-461-9226. I have a 2016 Audi. Went in for some service at 30,000 miles. They insisted on changing my brake fluid. What's up with that? That from Jim. What's the story there, Dan?
Well, the manufacturer does recommend that, and it might be a little excessive, but might not also. The brake fluid that we have in our cars absorbs moisture, just because that's the compounds that it's made out of, and it absorbs moisture from the humidity in the air and the humidity in your garage and all that sort of stuff, and it's pretty much sealed, but not perfectly sealed. There's a vent cap on it that, you know, allows air in and out, and that's the way it's designed. But because it gets moisture in it, because the internal components have a tendency to corrode a little bit, no matter how careful you are with it, they recommend changing the fluid. And by doing so, it takes the moisture out. It makes the brake pedal quality better. And more importantly, it protects all of the internal components on the braking system. And when we're dealing with the valves and so forth on anti-lock brakes, that's a pretty big deal. That stuff needs to be kept clean and working properly. So, it, like I say, it might be a little excessive to do it at 30,000 miles, but if they're recommending, I probably would do it. I'm a pretty big advocate of doing what the manufacturer recommends and being religious about it. Do it what they recommend and when they recommend it.
Oh, good stuff, Dan. Hey, a quick one here, if we can. How often should I have the oil changed when I use the car for less than 3,000 miles per year? Your take on that, Dan Burns?
I used to say twice a year, but since COVID, I've backed off that saying, well, you need to at least do it every year. For more reasons than just the oil, you need to bring the car in at least once a year and have it all checked over, have the tires checked, all the other fluids. You need to check all the steering and brake components and be sure that they're all safe. And the only way to do that is if you bring it in for service. So don't bring it in for just a quick oil change. That's not what you're looking for. What you're looking for is a more comprehensive annual inspection, and be sure that you get all of that when you bring it in.
Okay, I remember an advertising campaign from some time ago where some manufacturer of, I don't know, motor oil, whatever, said, think months, not just miles. I think that was their approach way back then. Dan Burns from Lloyd's Automotive, which you'll find in St. Paul. What's the cross street on Grand Avenue there?
We're on Chatsworth, which is right between Lexington and Victoria.
Ah, okay. And tell people again how they find Lloyd's Automotive.
Well, find us on the web at lloydsautomotive.net, L-L-O-Y-D-S, lloydsautomotive.net. Come on over. We are at 982 Grand Avenue, which I said is right between Lexington and Victoria. Or give us a call as soon as this morning. I see Jim just pulled up to the shop. So he'll be answering the phone shortly at 651-228-1316.
Good stuff. Hey, Dan, nice to have a chance to catch up with you just briefly here. And I'll remind you, Denny Long will be back with you, and I am proud just to have this chance to fill in here on WCCO. It's great to be back for even just a brief bit. Dan Burns from Lloyd's Automotive in St. Paul, you have a great week, and we will check back with you again coming up here at News Talk 830 WCCO.
Thank you, John.